So the background is this: this guy named Kevin Van Trump. He is probably in his 50s, late 50s. And he basically, I think he worked in Chicago on like the commodities, like trading floor. So he like traded commodities, but he's got a relatively thick Southern accent.
Right.
So he goes to Chicago. He probably makes 8 figures trading commodities. So he like sounds like this country bumpkin farmer, but like, you know, he's trading like corn futures and shit like that and makes a lot of money. Then maybe 10 years ago, he starts this daily newsletter where he writes the whole thing by himself every single day. At this point,
for like 17 years, he's done that.
Is it 17 years?
Something like that. It's like some almost 20 years he's been doing this every day.
And it makes like something like in the world of $20 million a year in subscription revenue just to read. It's more
now. I think it's like 30, 40 million a year now.
So I've done calls with him and I'm just, and this guy who's like, oh, hey, check this son of a bitch out. Like, that's what he'll say.
Yeah.
Okay, so I haven't talked to you in like 2 weeks. You had COVID.
I can't even explain what I had. I would apologize because I missed so many recordings, but in a way, you gave me COVID because I got COVID because I went to this conference, which is, a decision I made. I wasn't really thinking about it. COVID has just been so present that I wasn't really like, I didn't do the math of like, you know, if I go on a plane and I go to a conference with 2,000 people, what's going to happen? And so sure enough, I go to this conference that Sam hooks me up with. Sam's like, hey, this conference is amazing. It's called FarmCon. These guys who run it, there's a super cool story. You know, it's awesome. And I was like, oh, I'm in.
And I was going to go.
And I land and I'm like, yo, I'm here, baby. Let's do this. And Sam's like, oh, I didn't go, dude. I didn't want to get COVID.
Well, I canceled like last minute. I thought that you knew that I canceled, but
how would I know that?
Because we had talked about you going and we hadn't said, I don't know. We had not really mentioned you, like, I'll see you there.
Yeah.
And I thought you knew I canceled. So I felt horrible, but like a week or two prior to that's like when Omicron and all this stuff happened. And it's a farmers conference in Kansas City. I'm from Missouri. And I was like, ooh, I think that that COVID will be there. Yeah, and I don't know if I would.
COVID was for sure there. It was the main attendee, the main keynote speaker. We walked in. So I walk in, Ben went with me. And so we go in and me and Ben are literally the only two people in the room with a mask. And there's like 2,000 people in there. And I was like, ah, shit. I didn't even really think about it. And I was like, oh, fuck, it's here. And I was like, well, the odds of me getting there are pretty high, but I'm now here. So I got to just make the most of it. So anyways, basically I go to this conference, and everything that could happen to get COVID happened. Meaning like, it's like, conferences in this ballroom. Great. It's 2,000 people in one room. All right. That's not so good. They don't have masks on. Okay. It's next thing to happen. I go to the gym in between, like the sessions me and Ben want to get a workout in. We meet this guy, we're making small talk and we're like, oh, you here for the conference? He's like, no, I'm just quarantining here. My girlfriend has COVID, so I'm here.
Oh my God.
And I was like, bro, I just shook your hand and what am I doing? And so then this guy, my gym buddy's got COVID. I was like, oh, great. And then I get on the plane finally to come back. I'm like, all right, I think I might've made it out unscathed. I don't know. I'm feeling okay. Plane gets stuck on the runway for 3 hours. So I'm on a plane in a closed tube with a bunch of other people for 3 hours. So I was like, all right, it's over. I got COVID. And sure enough, I get home and 2 days later, I get COVID. Now, the dumb thing I didn't do was I didn't quarantine right away, which I should have just done. I should have just said, hey, even if I'm not feeling anything, I've been around a bunch of people, I should just like leave. But I was like, look, I just left my wife at home with the two babies for like, 4 days. I should come back and help. And in trying to help, I ended up giving my wife COVID. Then we gave both our babies COVID. And so for the last 10 days, it's just been someone in my house has COVID at any given time. And I've just been literally, I haven't gone to a computer. I haven't done anything.
Did Ben get it?
Taking care of it.
You don't become the world's most valuable women's sports franchise by accident. Angel City Football Club did it with a little help from HubSpot. When they started, data was housed across multiple systems. HubSpot unified their website, email marketing, and fan experience in one platform. This allowed their small team of three to build an entire website in just 3 days. The results were nearly 350 new signups a week and 300% database growth in just 2 years. Visit HubSpot.com to hear how HubSpot can help you grow better. All right, back to the pod.
Ben did not get it. I think Ben had it like a month ago. So he somehow came out unscathed.
Did Sully get it?
He didn't go. He didn't end up going. He flaked the night of and was like, actually, like, it's super inconvenient to get there. I have to like change my flight has like a stopover. Fuck this. I'm not going. We'll do something else.
So was it in you? But you were, even though you're vaccinated, you got sick.
I got really sick. Yeah, I got really sick for 3 days. So let me tell you about my COVID experience. I got really sick for 3 days, but it's just the flu with a side dose of paranoia because it's like, oh, this ain't the flu. This is COVID. And so definitely, you know, fever, all that good stuff, whatever. Then the babies, everybody had kind of the same thing. But the bad thing is, like, I don't know how you are, but I'm like a huge baby when I get sick.
Me too.
And my wife is like, you know, never gets sick. She's like one of those people just like never gets a cold, never has a runny nose, nothing. And so even with COVID, she was like, she fought it off pretty good. It was like pretty mild. You know, she was still doing like,
I think women are generally tougher, particularly moms are tougher when it comes to that stuff.
Totally. But the hard part is when we both get the same thing and I go down like a, you know, bag of bricks and she's like,
shut the fuck up, don't complain.
Yeah. She's just like, what is this? Why do you need so much sleep right now? And I'm like, I just can't explain. In fact, I saw this meme that was so perfect. It goes, is this guy? he goes, you know, it's so good that women have to give birth and go through labor because now they understand what happens when a man gets a cold. And that's how it is. I'm a huge baby about it. And she like toughed it out. No problem. So that was kind of embarrassing.
Did so how many people, how many full time employees work at your company? The D2C company.
Maybe like 7-8. Full-time
and these in Americans full-time and you like are running
meetings. Not all Americans but you know, people who this is their main job, they work full-time.
And when you
not counting the warehouse staff.
And do you like do weekly meetings with them and run it like a company, or is it really no. Sean, if it's run like Sean, like very autonomous, everything done via Slack?
Very autonomous, everything done via Slack. We have one meeting a week that's in Slack. And I just say, hey, get in this channel right now. We just did it. It was at 10:30. It's like, all right, get in this channel right now. And I just say, all right, you, everybody here. And then they just like emoji react. And then I'm like, cool. This is like a real meeting, meaning like don't go open 10 other tabs. Like when I say something, I want a response within like a second because it's like a live chat. I was like, but calls are annoying. We all agree calls are annoying. So let's just like do the, like just humor me. Let's try this meeting style. So we do it. I kind of like it. And basically I just say, all right, what's everybody's main priority this week? Like what matters? Everyone's like, oh, we got to do this, this, this. I say, then I'll be like, that doesn't really sound that like that matters that much. Can we punt that? They're like, yeah, I guess so. And like, we just agree on here's the three or four things that matter this week. You're doing this, you're doing this, you're doing this. And then it's like, cool. I tell one guy, I say, hey, check in on Wednesday. And everybody just say how they're going on their things for the week. And then check in on Friday and say, hey, how did we do for the week? That's it. That's
and how the much time does your wife spend on the company?
Spends a good amount of time. Like she's a stay at home mom, I guess, like first job. Cause like, so during the day, she doesn't really work on it too much, just kind of like on her phone in between, you know, just like watching the baby. But then at night, she basically works from 10 p.m. when the babies are finally knocked out to 2 or 3 a.m. Pretty much every night she does that, and she works on the business. Wow. And does the designs and all that stuff.
So when you guys are both sick, how bad, like who's...
We did no work.
You just have a person who you trust and you say, just handle it.
Wow. We're like, you know, just you do what you can do. And then whatever doesn't get done, doesn't get done. Like, we're not going to worry about it. We're not going to add a stress to our life that like says this week we also have to, you know, work. It's just impossible.
So let's talk about this conference for a second, because I have been telling you about this guy for a long time. And I think that you humored me and the audience has humored me. And they're like, oh, that sounds neat. But when you got to meet him, did you understand what I was saying?
Dude, this guy is amazing. This guy is amazing, and what he's built is amazing. So I want to go through, I have a bunch of thoughts, but let's start with them. Okay, so the conference called FarmCon, and the family is called the Van Trump family. That's their name. So it's Kevin Van Trump and Jordan Van Trump. That's like the two kind of like core principles. That's the father and son. And I'm just going to describe what happened when I got there, because it wasn't like a normal conference. So a couple unusual things. I go in and there's a normal stage, like a conference, you know, like they got that freaking wallpaper behind it. That's like every sponsor's logo on step and repeat banner. Okay, cool. That everything's normal. But the main speaker, Kevin Van Trump, is sitting not in a chair. He's got this like mahogany desk that was put onto the stage, and he's sitting in it. He looks like a judge of a courtroom. So he's got this humongous like oak wood table that he's sitting behind in his thing, and he's got a gavel literally, and he's talking into the mic, and it's just like a free form agenda. So he'll be like, he would just say something that he'd be like, I walked in and he's like, yeah, that's why I don't hire any Ivy Leaguers. You know, Ivy Leaguers, here's the problem with Ivy Leaguers. And he'll just go on a rant. There's like five panelists that are sitting there, and then he'll just like tell this story, and the crowd loves him. I loved him. He is an amazing, charismatic speaker who is smart and very real. And he's just a very good speaker. Like his style was so likable. I can't explain. So
the background is this guy named Kevin Van Trump. This is all from memory. I met him 4 or 5 years ago at a conference, and since then I've kind of brought him into our circle of friends. He is probably in his 50s, late 50s. And he basically, I think he worked in Chicago on like the commodities like trading floor. So he like traded commodities, but he's got a relatively thick Southern accent. Kansas City, Missouri isn't really considered the South, but it can be pretty country. But I don't know where he's from. So he goes to Chicago. He probably makes 8 figures trading commodities. So he like sounds like this country bumpkin farmer, but like, you know, he's trading like corn futures and shit like that. And makes a lot of money. Then maybe 10 years ago, he starts this daily newsletter where he writes the whole thing by himself every single day. At this point,
for like 17 years, he's done that.
Is it 17 years?
Something like that. It's like almost 20 years he's been doing this every day.
And it makes like something like in the world of $20 million a year in subscription revenue just more. To read. It's more
now. More is now. It? I think it's like 30, 40 million a year now.
So I've done calls with him, and I'm just, and this guy who's like, oh, hey, check this son of a bitch out. Like, that's what he'll say. Yeah. And he's like, he's like pointing at his new Picasso. So I've done video calls with him, and he's got like this like beautiful like chopper in the background, like a fancy customized motorcycle. He goes, oh, we just picked up this son of a bitch. We just got this son of a bitch the other day. We really love the Picassos. And that's how he talks. And he now his family, Kevin or Jordan, his younger son, runs like this other business. But in the commodities world, this like farming world, they are gods. And I've met a bunch of the people who like them, and they're like New York-ish type folks who have like $50-100 million and are like traders, and they like revere him and they love him.
Dude, so have you read any of his newsletters?
They're so good. Yeah, must pay subscribers.
First, they're like, you know, it's like a 20-page PDF. So it's like not even like a short thing. It's like a long thing. And it's like he basically is writing about what he thinks is going on. So in the market. So he'll be like, you know, bean futures or, you know, rice or corn, these different commodities. He's talking about what's going on. It's really important for people in agriculture, because if you're a farmer and you're making you're growing corn, you got to decide, do I hold this corn and try to sell it myself? Do I need to take on some insurance in case the price of corn drops? And should I sell, you know, all of my corn, you know, in this futures market? Or should I, you know, should I hedge, but should I take a hedged position against what I'm producing? And so you have to decide what you're going to do with your crop. That is your, like for most people, investing is this like side thing. It's like you do your job that earns you your money, your business that earns you your money, and then you invest in the stock market and whatever. They're two separated things. For a farmer, these are not separated. This is part of the like core thing of what you do, is basically managing your risk.
And these aren't guys that have like a farm that like they just like get by. These are like folks that like supply the corn to like McDonald's. And we're talking like they have turnover of 20, 30, $50 million a year.
Like here's that. Yeah. He's like, you know, you'll meet the guy who makes all the rice for Chipotle. It's like, whoa, that's crazy. That's crazy volume. And then I would meet people who were like what you call gentleman farmers. They're basically people who don't need to farm. They just grew up that way. And they're like, yeah, my family, I like living on a farm. I want my family to have a farm. I farm on my weekends and nights. Like there's one guy, he's a CEO of a large company, and he was just farming for fun, you know, nights and weekends. And that's why he was, you know, like there. And it was like such a bad use of like time, but it's not a bad use of time because it's a hobby. It's a pleasurable thing for him. What this manual work is like how he relaxes.
All right, folks, this is a quick plug for a podcast called I Digress. If you're trying to grow your business but feel like you're drowning in buzzwords and BS, then check out the I Digress podcast. It's hosted by this guy named Troy Sandage. He's helped launch over 35 brands that drive $175 million in revenue. So if you want to get smarter about scaling your business, listen to I Digress wherever you get your podcasts. All right, back to the pod.
How many people were there?
So it was about 1,500 people. And so let me explain this guy, their business. Okay, so they have what I'll call three separate components, maybe four. Okay, so there's the newsletter, the paid newsletter that basically you subscribe to, you pay $1,000 a year. And my guess, based on some triangulation, is that that's making about $30 to $40 million a year now in annual subscription revenue. And he's writing that, we'd be hanging out. It was like maybe midnight. He's at the hotel bar or whatever, we're hanging out. And I was like, so... like, you know, who on your team writes the letter? He's like, I wish, you know, I write the letter. He's like, I gotta go right up to my room right after this. Go write that some bitch. And he's like, you know,
that's how he talks.
Yeah, he's like, I don't know why the fuck I did this. And he's like, I created a job for myself. He's like, I told my son, I said, you need to, the best job in the world is investing. You should invest. Don't do what I did. I created a job for myself. And I have to write this thing every day. But, you know, I love it. Whatever.
And it's really ugly. Have you seen it? It's like, it's not mobile friendly. It's just a PDF. And it's like 3,000 words with like PowerPoint images.
It's all substance over style. There's a few memes in there, which I like. It's like, you know, just here's some jokes. And I think that's very on brand.
But it is good. The writing's great.
The writing is really great. And the insights obviously matter. Otherwise, people wouldn't be paying for this thing, right? They're genuinely getting value. And at the conference, he's a god, dude. People love this guy. They respect his kind of like knowledge and his content. And then they just really like him. Because again, he would say, I literally wrote down verbatim things that he was saying. Because I was like, this is just like, this is so entertaining. Like, for example, I'm just going to read you a couple of quotes on that he was saying. So he's like, I hate hiring Ivy Leaguers because they're too afraid of failure. He's like, they've done so well their whole life. They're not used to looking wrong or looking silly. You know, go try NFTs. Go put your hands on the wheel. Go fall. Go scrape your knee. He's like, that's how I grew up. My dad would take us in the car. He said, no seatbelts, baby. That's how we roll. he's like, we're going to take some risks. We're going to get skinned up. We're going to break some bones. We're going to fall off the bike. He's like, that's how you got to treat your kids. Even if they're smart kids, you got to, he's like, because one of the big concerns is how do you get your kid? You're 60 maybe now, and you got your farm. Your kid's 30. They don't want to take over the farm, or they don't. Maybe they want to, but they don't know how to do anything.
And
so he's like, you got to segment off a portion of the farm, let them fail, but let them have the skin in the game. He's like, you know, I want to have kids that don't melt down when the rug gets pulled. I want to be able to go to them and say, hey, things have changed, and we're changing tonight. And he's just like going on this rant. And dude, I'm sitting there in the crowd and I'm like, world star. I'm like, this is such a hype monologue, and it had nothing to do with whatever they were talking about, like bean futures 5 seconds before that. But he would frequently go on these, and every time I'm just nodding my head, I'm like, preach. I was at this dinner with him, and people were like, it was kind of like these guys had organized this dinner, they're paying for it, but then they, as part, you know, like sort of, what's the catch? It was, we're going to pitch our idea to Kevin and a couple other guys who we want to invest in it. And they pitched their idea, and he's like, cool. So who's the audience? Who's the customer for this? And they're like, well, you know, we've done extensive psychographic research. They slid over this thing. He's like, psychographic? I don't know what that means, man. What the fuck are you saying? Who is the customer? And they're like, it's not demographic. He's like, it's a psychographic profile. He's like, no, like name them. Do you know five people who want this product? Like, would this guy want this product? Hey, you over there at the table, would you want this product? And the guy's like, no, I wouldn't want it. And then he's just like, and the guys are like, Kevin, you're not like being open-minded. He's like, I'm trying to help y'all. He's like, I've heard this idea 10 times and it failed. I invested in this one. It failed. And why did it fail? Because there was no customer for this product. And he's like trying to give him real talk. And it was so good. And the whole time I'm just like, wow, this guy's core business instincts are very strong. And his delivery method is fearless. I'm trying to do the impression because I want people to feel like what it felt like to hear this guy off the top of his head. It's so different than corporate America. It's so different than New York SF, where everybody's hedging every word and packaging everything and trying to deliver it and trying to make these fucking, you know, like criticism sandwiches where you say a positive thing, then a negative thing, then a positive thing to, like, you know, deliver the blow. Whereas he would just say the thing, and he did it in a way that came off great. I loved it.
What? All right. So you have a list of a bunch of shit that you've learned here. Let's just rattle them off. Well, I found them to be all wildly interesting.
Let's do a couple things. So the rest of his business. So he tells me, so he goes, I'm doing, I
know for sure his business was doing in the $25 million range years ago.
Right. So that's, so there's the newsletter component.
Yeah.
Then he's like, well,
two, you know, employees, this, by the way, I think. It's two.
Right. And he's like, you know, I don't, there's never been a sponsor. 15 years, John Deere comes to me. They say, we would love to sponsor. No. Trust for the audience. He had these principles where he's like, these people are going to trust me because I'm not going to be selling them to somebody. And so he was like, you know, I'm going to do it this way and I'm going to stick to my guns. And so, and he's never done never like run ads to advertise this thing. It's all organic, word of mouth, one person sharing it with another saying, you got to check this thing out, forwarding it to somebody else saying, hey, you see what he's saying about where the market's going? And then that person's like, shit, I need these insights. And so that's an amazing, you know, that's probably 90% profit, 95% profit, like more. on that 30 million, right?
Like, I think ridiculous. He uses, I like what was talking about, which email, like, it's so raw. I think he uses Salesforce to send it out.
Right.
Like, that's his something email crazy. Service provider. Like, it's pretty raw.
So then the second piece of the business is, I think that there's now a secondary thing that's happened many, many years in, which is like a big company will come to them and say, hey, you know, I'm just going to, for argument's sake, Chipotle's like, hey, we need somebody who's going to grow soy in this region. So he's just like, hey, I know, like, they're like, you know, everybody. And so he's like, cool. Yeah, I can find you people who can produce what you need. And they were like, cool. If we pay them, let's call it $5 a bushel, you know, we'll make it $5.50 and you keep your 50 cents as a broker fee. So I think that now produces as much as the newsletter. So let's double it. Basically, let's tack that on. Now the third thing is investing. So they basically had this, you know, they're like, well, everybody keeps coming to pitch us ag tech. They don't know what the fuck they're talking about. We know everybody in this space. So they then started investing. And I think they just had their biggest hit. There's something called Benson Hill or Benson's Hill or something like that went public. So, you know, like the first kind of like public unicorn that they seeded. And the last one is the most interesting one of all. This is what the Sun is doing. So do you know about this? Yeah, Ag Swag. So here's the backstory that he tells about this. And I'm not sharing anything private. Like, he told this on stage. He goes, met a guy who he like moved into my neighborhood type of thing. And he used to be, you know, big shot exec at some company. And he's like, cool. Like, what are you doing now? He's like, oh, I'm doing this kind of like either this buyout, like leverage buyout, or I'm going to become a CEO of this company called American Identity. We make t-shirts and hats. And he's like, all right. Kind of lame, like, you're selling t-shirts now, like, you've done some big shit, why are you doing that? A few years later, fast forward, that company American Identity sells to Staples for $8 billion, and he looks at that, he's like, what the hell? He's like, that t-shirt company, what the hats, custom hats, like, what the fuck? And he's basically like, yeah, he's like, who are your biggest customers? He's like, oh yeah, my three biggest customers are Cargill, ADM, and John Deere. And he's like,
uniforms,
what's that?
Is that, are they making uniforms or they're just making licensed merchandise? So like, I think if you buy like, John Deere, they're just are printing it for them.
They're making it for John Deere. John Deere might have employee. They have, you know, 2000 employees. They want to send
a John Deere hat
or a vest with a green John Deere vest or whatever. And so he's like, those are your biggest accounts. Like, those are my buddies. Like, I know all those guys. And so after they sell or whatever, him and his son, they create Ag Swag, agricultural swag. It's the same idea, but now they go to all those accounts and they say, hey, you want like vests and fleece and hats and whatever. And you got, you know, 100 employees in your office in Brazil, you need to send some stuff to. Cool. We got you. And I think this is going to be a really big business also. And so they are doing very well. He was saying they outgrew their warehouse. They're trying to, you know, expand and all this. He was telling me, I want to say any of the numbers for that part. He was telling me some of the square footage they need in the warehouse. And I know, from the DTC space, I know if you need that much square footage, you are putting out pretty crazy volume. So I thought that was amazing as well. But what an example of just being a big fish in and not even a really small pond, right? It seems like a niche, but it's like agriculture, yeah, pretty huge niche. Like,
you know, my parents work in this industry, and that's why I like this guy, because I got to know him. Is but like the thing that people like guys like you and me and people listening to this were these tech folks, and we dismiss this, but like literally everyone in America has an onion in their home or a product made of an onion,
right?
And you're going to buy it multiple times a week. That's what my dad does. My dad sells onions, and I remember people I would make fun of him, and he's like, go look in your cabinet. You have stuff that I have owned at one point, I bet. And so it's not as small as we think.
Oh, I mean, obviously it's not like, for example, the founder of Square, this guy, Jim McAvey, I want to talk about him too. He was the keynote speaker. So he comes on the stage. He was also a very good speaker. I kind of have a high bar for that kind of thing, but he was very impressive. And he gets on stage. The very first thing he says is, just want to say thank you to everybody in this room for feeding my family. You know, it's like, but it's like such an obvious thing. But I say, yeah, of course. Where all the shit we eat comes from somewhere. And in my mind, this is going to sound super dumb and ignorant, but it's true, which is like, before this conference, I really spent 0% of my time thinking about where the heck food comes.
And if you thought of a farmer, you probably had stupid stereotypes of like dumb idiots.
For sure. I was like, oh, and going into this, I was like, oh, I'm going to go meet a bunch of hillbilly like rednecks, yeah. Basically was my
And they do plan. Talk like that. I'm from there. they definitely will talk like that, but they like are wearing like a $50,000 Rolex.
And when I get there, they're like, you know, yeah, you know, put options on bean futures and, you know, with Brazil coming on board, you know, I'm going to take this hedged position against corn. And I was like, oh, wait, y'all are like fucking Wall Street traders. Wait, what? And I was like, okay, maybe it's just a couple of these guys. And I was like, no, and then I would meet guys in the hallway and I'd be like, what do you do? Oh, my family always owned a farm in South Dakota for 40 years. Okay, cool. So I was like, do you do this? Like kind of like fucking soybean oil futures? And they're like, yeah, you got to. And I was like, what? I was like, how do you know? He's like, well, we got a broker, but like, you know, it's key to the business. You got to be doing it. And I was like, holy shit. Like, you guys are more sophisticated financially than anybody I know. Like, I could go to in Silicon Valley, I could go to talk to engineers or angel investors, VCs, and I could be like, hey, explain to me how a derivatives contract works, or explain to me how the corn futures market looks. And nobody would know what the fuck they're talking about. Nobody would know what to say.
Dude, now, okay, so you've not made fun of me, but teased me a little bit about like loving trucks and farmers. Now do you understand why I think it's so cool? Like, these guys are sophisticated and everything, but like the people you and I hang out with in our coastal cities, they don't give a fuck about these folks. And I'm like, man, if you got to make those collide, it'd be awesome.
Right. And so a couple things like on that note. So when I was at one of the dinners, they were talking about, it was the who's the customer dinner. They're talking about something and something came up. They go, you know, how long, he's like, how long we've been here about Whole Foods and, you know, plant-based this and oat milk that. He's like, this is still tiny fringe shit. He goes, America eats corn, bread, and milk at scale. This is what America wants. They need, how much volume is the Whole Food? And then I'm thinking, dude, in my bubble, everybody eats like that. Everybody yeah. eats the fringe shit. So it was just awareness of like two things. One is like, in the future, maybe what we're doing ends up becoming more mainstream. I do believe that. Not. But how not it is crazy. The scale, the difference in scale of just like, you know, corn versus, you know, the non-Whole Foods versus Whole Foods is like, to them, Whole Foods was this rounding error. And I thought that was hilarious because to me, it's like, you know, that's like, I don't know where I shop every day. It's the main thing. And again, all this is going to sound really like dumb, but, I'm dumb. That's, I guess, the answer. When I was there, I was learning how dumb I was about everything. There were so many different things like that that I was learning. Can I just rattle off a couple yeah. other things? Okay, I so love this.
Jonathan, write us in the chat. Is this? I could talk about this all day. I think this is the coolest shit ever.
So I'm going to give you a couple of pain points and or business ideas that I saw or heard when I was there, or just am making up because like, oh, maybe this. So one thing is, even though I'm like, oh, these guys are really sophisticated, there's no way that they want to be that sophisticated about this. All these like kind of financial products that they have to use for hedging the crops they produce and the insurance and all that good stuff. So I think that some kind of wealth front type of robo advisor that basically just does all the work for them to manage their risk is going to be like important, because every single one of them is like, yeah, we have a broker we call and we talk to him and he tells us X, Y, Z. And he tells us what he thinks we should be doing. And we come up with a position we want to take, and then we take it. So that to me felt very old. And I feel like if somebody does a robo-advisor thing, that's interesting. Kevin Van Trump had an idea. He goes, I want to make a Rally Road. And I think we've talked about Rally Road on here, which is basically Rally Road is like this app you open up and you can buy a fraction of cool memorabilia. So it'd be like a sweet old car or first edition Harry Potter signed book set.
And it's awesome. In my opinion, Rally Road has one of the best apps I've seen in like the last 2 or 3 years.
Super nice app. Company I wish I invested in, honestly. I feel like I've been saying that for a year. Probably should have just done it at this point. But really cool product, really cool app. So he was saying, I think we could do Rally Road just for our stuff. And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, you know, just like the original, you know, motorcycle from Dukes and Hazzards. Or, you know, and again, all the references flew over my head. He said them really fast, but like,
it was
basically just cool hick shit. Yeah. And I was like, oh, that's probably actually a really good idea because these guys got money and they care about this stuff. And there's like a network effect of just speaking to that audience.
Dude, didn't I tell you? You know how I used to work for the show American Pickers.
Right.
You were not in the market for that because you were in, were you in Australia at the time? Whatever, but you, if the show was around now, you wouldn't watch that. You don't fit that bill. But do you know that show American? So for those listening, I used to work for the show American Pickers, and it's basically like Pawn Stars. We'd go out.
What did you do for them?
So the main guy in the show, his name is Mike Wolf. He's the main character. He owned this store, and it was called Pickin'. And so you go and you just knock on doors, and you go to Barnes, and you find old memorabilia, and you either sell it in your own stores, or you sell it to antique shops, or you sell it on eBay. And like the antique shops, they have to get it from somewhere. They get it from pickers. This guy like would buy old bicycles. That's a big market. Or he would buy like a old 1936 Harley for 10 grand and sell it for 30 grand. That type of stuff. And he owned the store and he started filming himself pre-YouTube for like 5 years to make the show popular, pitching it to the History Channel year after year after year, getting declined. Finally, they said, all right, this is cool. He's a good looking guy, charismatic guy. They pick up the show. He was not rich off the pick and stuff, but he was like making a living. Gets rich because he licenses the show. He's the producer. He owned all the rights. I work at the store where we would sell the stuff that he bought, his picks. But so many people would come to the store that basically we sold 30 grand a day of t-shirts and shot glasses.
Wow.
And because he was like, eventually he wouldn't even sell the picks anymore. Cause he was like, I need stuff for people to look at when they're in the store.
Right.
And he probably made, his business was probably doing $30, $40 million a year off all of his stuff. And when the show was on, when the show was live, it's still live now, but it's past its heyday. When it was live, we were the second or third most popular show on TV, on all of TV. And we would have people flying from all over the world just to come and look at the stuff I helped run the store, but like half the time I was just holding the door and making sure that we weren't at capacity. And the reason I'm bringing this up is this whole Rally Road for Middle America shit. This is the real stuff. And like buying like these rare baseball cards or whatever it is, that's the fringe. And Rally Road has built a great business on top of that.
Exactly. And by the way, if you were going to start this, I would I'd email Sam and CC me just so I didn't get to know. But B, I would go to these guys like Mike Wolf. I would go find these kind of like all American influencers, and I would use them to help promote the app and help get them on board to grow this thing. And I think this is kind of like you go where nobody else is fishing. I think there's just not much competition to build technology products in that space. Let me tell you a couple other ideas that were in there. So any kind of fintech for farmers. So part of it's like this Wealthfront idea, but also just like, I've invested in 6 companies that are all just variations of like, you know, Brex or Mercury Bank. So basically like there's 2 startups that got big that were serving entrepreneurs, serving tech startups. One is Mercury, which is just saying, hey, instead of going and using Bank of America or Wells Fargo, just use Mercury as your bank, right? We have a slick interface. It's a mobile app. You never got to talk to a banker, you know, free wire transfer.
But it's not really a bank. It's, they're partnering with another bank and they just layer their branding on top of that bank.
They're on top. Exactly. But they've done really well. They're now valued over $1 billion. You know, this guy who built it, Imad, he's kind of in our friends group.
He's awesome.
And, you know, he's great. He came on the pod. So, you know, so Mercury is bank for tech startups. And then Brex was Visa for tech startups. And same thing, not, you know, they're built on top of the Visa rails or the MasterCard rails or whatever. But it's just a credit card for startups, and it was taking advantage of that. Like, hey, we understand startups. So, like, for example, you might be a startup that's raised $10 million of venture capital, but your credit card limit is $5,000 because the bank's like, dude, you have no income, no history, no nothing, no credit. Like, you know, we can't give you money. And they're just like, so dude, I just raised $10 million. I have the money in the bank, like in this bank.
Or they won't cap points on ad spend because they know that startups spend most of their money on ad spend.
Exactly. Things like that. Or things like, you know, just the fact like, hey, you can fill out the application online. You don't have to talk to a human and it'll be like sent to you in 2 days. Or like, you know, you want this to like easily autofill online. Like there's just little stuff that makes it like work well for that audience.
So Mercury for farmers on board. So
Brex became a multi-billion dollar thing. Mercury did. And I've now invested in versions of either Mercury or Brex for teenagers, for teens in India, for businesses in India, for Canadians.
Creators is the one that everyone
for creators.
About.
Dude, I did that one
creators.
Too.
Make this for food creators. This it'd be so much better to food do this. Creators. Yeah, it's gonna be creators.
That's what we call farmers.
That's what we call farmers.
We're gonna rebrand farming as the creator economy. They're just creating food.
Yeah, seed creators. dude, it's so much. That would be such a better company.
And they're spending a lot of money, right? Because like all of it, the equipment, the like, you know, the fertilizers, these are like huge bulk purchases.
Dude, my cousins, I have an aunt and cousin who it's a mom and son. They have 1,500 acres with like 1,000 cattle or so. And I've gone out and hung out with them. And so they basically raise bulls to, it's called bucking bulls. So like at a rodeo, the bull that is like, it's called, that bull is bucking. And at a rodeo, the guy, the cowboy who stays on wins money, and the bull that bucks the hardest wins money. And you can also make money by, if you have a really good bucking bull, you get money by getting its semen out there. And all the females, they kill and turn into beef. And they make a living doing this. They're probably millionaires, but they are fucking hard workers. And when they walk around places, like during a workday, because like when you're a farmer, you're constantly driving to get feed, whatever, they'll have 20 G's on them in cash.
Wow.
Like, they just have just, like, fat loads of, like, you just need, or, like, when they go to the rodeo.
Rappers and farmers, dude.
When they go to the rodeo, I've seen them, they've had, like, 10 grand on them because they got to, like, buy this while they're there. They got to do this. They got to make their bet. Anyway, these farmers have fuckloads of cash because they're still doing stuff with cash. So, like, this is an interesting.
It's a great market.
Yeah.
With, the other one, automation. So, I think the number one thing that was on everybody's mind is automation. How do we get more automation? So I think from the beginning, technology has helped farms, which is like, you know, before there was tractors, everything was like, you know, horse pulled, you know, and or whatever. And then tractors come out and it becomes a big deal. And John Deere is trying to do self-driving tractors and everybody's trying to do automation. And so I think if you're sitting at MIT or you're at Carnegie Mellon and you're in some robotics lab and you're like, okay, I can keep making like, you know, things that I understand that are from, you know, this gadget that like turns off my light switch in my room because I don't like to get up once I lay down. Yeah, so that's what I'm going to do. It's like, dude, instead, go to a farm for like 3 weeks and just watch what's going on. And then from there, come up with the automations and stuff you want to pull.
I've invested in a few companies in that space. So it's automations and precision agriculture, they call it. So I think automation falls under precision agriculture. That's like the term, I believe. And it's incredibly interesting. So like you talk about like automated autonomous tractors is incredibly intriguing.
Right. And there's also like sensors. So just like soil quality is like the soil health is like one of the most important things. If your soil health is bad, your crop is fucked. And so just being able to come up with models where you can go put sensors in the ground and get real-time soil health data and alert people, hey, this plot in this area is not going to grow very well because of this. That also seemed like a big deal. So those are some ideas. The last one is family succession planning. So one of the biggest things was like, how do you pass down your farm? Because if your kids don't want to do it, and increasingly, you know, kids don't want to do it, what the heck are you going to do with this farm? And so there was like places that you can sell farms. So I think that was one opportunity. There's creating your estate, your will, and all that stuff. There's renting it out to other people. There was just a whole bunch of stuff around, okay, if billions of dollars of farms is going to trade hands in the next like 10 years, who's going to be in the middle of that?
And I think working with, remember one, we had one episode where we talked about picking your customer and we were talking about this company, User Voice or User Testing. Which one did your mom work for?
User Testing.
And I was like, I think that's so cool because it gives people like your mom, like moms who raise kids and can't have full-time jobs. It gives them work. That's admirable. That's exciting. That's incredibly motivating. I think I would easily put farmers in that same situation or in that same category where it would be really exciting and fun to work with those guys.
Right. Right. Totally. There was a couple startups there that I liked. One was called Acre Trader. So these guys, now they've raised like $60 million. I think Peter Thiel invested in them. And basically it's just fractional land ownership of farms. So the idea is I could go on there today and I could put down $1,000 and buy a piece of a farm in North Dakota. And I can make 8 to 11% a year on that thing. And I could diversify. I could own pieces of 5 farms in 5 different states that do 5 different things. And then there's a farmer on the farm that does the work that's leasing the farm from you. You're just owning the land. And these guys, I think they... average farm that they were doing was like $2 million in size. And they did like 80 farms last year or something like that. So I was like, okay, that's actually pretty good. Like they basically buy the land and then fractionally sell it off. And then they take a broker fee. Plus they take a like management fee of 0.75% a year on top of that, just to manage just to be the property manager of the land.
So it sounds like this conference is badass. It changed your perspective on some stuff.
For sure. In fact, I actually just want to say, conferences in general, I think the general rap is conferences waste of time. You'll see that a lot on Twitter, especially from smart people. People say that. I have the exact opposite view. I think conferences are pure fucking alpha, meaning I think there's so much gains to be had at conferences. Number one, you leave your routine. And that's just frees the mind to just like get out of the like, get yourself out of the weeds and get somewhere else. Then when you meet somebody at a conference, there's like just meeting people in person. Like it's so crazy. You don't have to do anything with them.
You know that I met Kevin. I spoke at a conference and I was just hanging out in the lobby and Kevin Van Trump came up to me and he was wearing cowboy boots and a Ramones t-shirt. And I thought that he was like a weirdo. Like I did think that he was legit, but he was like talking like a big game, not like bragging, but kind of like he told me his business and he had like $100,000 watch on. And I was like, wait, you're telling me? He's like, yeah, I got 20,000 subscribers. I was like, oh, sick. You guys make money through ads? He goes, oh, no, paid subscription. I was like, wait, who are you? So
by the way, he remembered you. He gave a great intro when he was introducing me. He's like, I met this guy, Sam. He used to work for American Pickers and Boat. And he told the whole conference about you and how great you were. It was awesome.
And so anyway, I met Kevin at a conference, which now you've been brought into the fold. This is going to influence you in some capacity. You're totally going to bring other people into the fold. That's why conferences are cool.
Conference is cool. Secondly, go to weird conference. So if you just keep going to the same insular, I actually think that going to conferences that are not your industry is something that nobody really does. And I've always done, like I remember a restaurant trade show conference, and I've been to a gym owners conference. That's cool. And when you go, you just meet a whole bunch of people from a different, totally different walk of life. You see, what are they thinking about? What are the problems these guys are worried about? I'm sure out of this, I'll get some investors for my fund. I'll get some new ideas. I'll get some new perspective, and it just makes you a more interesting person. And so I would highly recommend going to trade shows specifically, but like, just different industry niches that are not yours, and just go to a sneaker conference and just be like, oh, what the hell are these sneakerheads doing? Like, who are these people? What do they do?
Yeah, right.
I know it's like a luxury if you have the time, but, if you work remotely anyways, go to one of these things, spend 4 hours on the floor, and then spend the other 5 hours or whatever at night, you know, working, and just work from there for the week. Or if you're young and you don't know what to do, don't just take a job. Like, go dabble, go travel around to 3 of these, and you'll just have like a totally different lens of things. So I think that's like a hack that, you know, I wanted to bring up. Yeah, it's crazy. By the way, these guys, the farmers, the best thing I got from them was their little one-liners. Like, one guy was telling the story about this investment he lost a bunch of money on. And people were like, damn, holy shit, you must have lost a lot. He goes, it was a sad day, but you know, that's why Johnny Walker makes a blue. And and then he was just like, move on. And I was just like, I'm writing these down. Like, these are bars, dude. These guys are amazing.
Can we, are we allowed to talk about?
I think so. Why not?
All right, let's talk about. So, do you want to give the bet?
We might want to bleep out his name. So let's bleep out his name. Just
well,
to
let's
say
talk
our
about
friend.
We'll ask him after this. But
all right,
there's this guy named. I didn't really know much about him, somehow I got brought into this group chat that you're in, and in a weird way, I feel like I'm good friends with him now, even though we've only texted.
Yeah.
He, how does he talk about what happened over the weekend about this app?
Okay, so so basically, here's his short story. He's built a couple of like products. Honestly, never really had a big hit. Him and his friends have been working on. They were working on a startup, or they're working as a startup for a number of years. And they were just grinding, running test after test, and they were really building a lot of stuff in the social space. So he learned a lot of like kind of the he like cut his teeth in trying to build the next Twitter, next TikTok, next whatever, right? And they were about to fail. The last thing they built, the Hail Mary, was they were like, oh, let's just create this like kind of like quiz app, this like superlatives app where it's like, oh, who at your high school is most likely to, you know, become a professional dancer or like, you know, go to jail or whatever. And it goes viral, and it's called TBH. And it goes viral. It hits like number one in the app store because this the flow was basically you open the app, you start answering these questions about your friends. And they would text your friends being like, hey, Sean said you're most likely to X. Click here to see what else he said. I was like, oh, dude, I'm going to click that. And then you click that, and then it would go on. Something along those lines. So TBH goes viral. Facebook ends up buying it. Smart move by kind of knew this thing doesn't have like, you know, legs to actually be the next hit social app. But
it made them like, you know, a good, not like, it, I don't think it sold for what it was reported as.
Yeah,
it was
reported selling as like $100 million, I think.
But it made, you know, a lifetime of money.
Yeah, exactly. So these guys, they pull it off in the end, right? So they went from like, literally they were about to shut it down. He's like, ah, oh, fuck it. Let's just launch this last thing. And that thing hits. So then he goes to Facebook. He stays there for like fucking full four years. So he hits the full vest. And he the whole time, I don't know, he's probably bored and he's just on Twitter and he's like, he's what people call shit posting, which is basically like, you know, just posting jokes on Twitter and oftentimes making fun of the tech industry. So making fun of the stuff that people in the tech industry are doing. And so anyways, he, you know, people like to follow him because he's funny. So over the weekend, so he tweeted something out last week that was like, hey, I'm going to work on a new project. I finally like left for Facebook or whatever. I'm working on a new project. I want to work with a designer. I'm looking for a founding designer. If you want to like, you know, build something amazing, work with a team that's built, you know, built apps, blah, blah, blah. You know, DM me something along those
and
lines.
And when he quit and announced that he was quitting at Facebook, it said, I've been at Facebook. They bought my app. I've been there for 4 years. It really was just, there was a lot happened and I want to give a thread on everything that I learned. And it down pointed girl. down, like the down emoji. And there was no other thread.
Nothing there. Yeah.
And it was hilarious.
here's what I learned my 4 years of Facebook. Nothing. And so, yeah, that was hilarious. And so people were like, oh, people generally are excited about next new thing, especially all the kind of like venture investors, angel investors. This is kind of the entrepreneur you like to back, which is somebody who you think is smart, who is a serial entrepreneur, so not their first rodeo, but also hasn't had the big win, so they still have a huge chip on their shoulder and wanna make it big. So that's like a great entrepreneur to invest in, and he's pretty well networked and pretty well respected, so people want to invest in it. So he tweets that thing out looking for a designer, and then somebody else said, somebody 2 days later just tweets like, I saw you know, a mock-up of a new app. Like, holy shit, it's going to like change everything. And this guy also is like a shit poster. This guy, I think his handle is like another Cohen or something like that. And by the way, you've seen the image that he's talking about. He's posted it in our text thread before about like, you know, here's an idea. Like, I might make this thing. And
if I remember like, correctly, it wasn't even like,
it's not a business. It's like, it's just like a silly idea. And it's like
high level screen. Idea. Still, yeah. He's still ideating. He doesn't exactly. Yeah.
So, anyways, people then start memeing that guy. They're like, I just saw a new app for the first time. And, you know, this wart that I've had on my toe for years just went away. And like, you know, the next person would be like, you know, I showed it to 8 children who were starving and now they're, you know, they're not hungry anymore. And so this goes viral as a meme on Twitter. I'm going to read you some of them that were there, the good ones.
They were great. They were great.
Let's see.
There was guys saying like, we're happy to announce that it was Andrew Chen. We're happy to announce that we just led in a $100 million round into a new app.
Right. I can't believe they're extending. I just got to a session with my therapist. She ended up asking me for tips on how to get allocation into a new company. And so it just became this like meme in the tech industry. And then a lot of people were seeing it like, dude, what's this app? And so, and by the way, this idea, this like kind of like what quote unquote growth hack, it was accidental, A, but B, really effective. And it drummed up a bunch of interest and a bunch of hype around what this new app could be.
And so what he did was he created an NFT with like, I think he sold
69.
So he's got, oh my God. He's got this really stupid like image for his Twitter picture, but it's kind of like funny. And he made different Twitter images based off of his, and 69 of them. And in, if you bought one, you get early access as a beta user to his app, right?
I don't know. Was that the promise? I didn't know.
Yeah, that's the promise. Look at the floor price of what those are.
So he goes, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce Nikita Shitposting Club, a collection of 69 owners will get access to, quote, app, parentheses, there is no app. It is now available on OpenSea. And so he links it and it sells out as NFTs do. And I think he made, what did he make off this thing? All right, the floor has dropped. So anybody who bought this, I think, is probably not doing so hot. The floor is now only 0.36 ETH. Ooh. So that's not great. But I mean, it's still $1,000. So 69 pictures for $1,000. Okay, not bad.
So here's what I want to ask you. I want to ask you a question because you have done something similar. I didn't know before you introduced me to him. I knew him as like a guy who built an app, but it seems like people revere him. Like they consider him an expert on consumer apps. Which not saying that he isn't. He certainly is pretty successful, it seems.
But also what the fuck?
but also like his reputation like is so big exceeds, where it's like,
yeah.
Is anyone that good? That's kind of what I'm gonna get.
Yeah.
And you've done a good job of that as well, of creating this like mystique, almost yeah. out of nothing, right? Not that yes. like you weren't successful totally. Ahead of time, but like you've done a really good job of building a brand.
Call it what I sold my startup for less than what my investors had put in. Now, you know, the way it worked, you know, the team still did well and I made good money off of it, but like that's not the definition of a successful business. Like,
because there's a lot of people that have sold their companies for a lot of money. We have a handful of buddies that are like uber yeah. rich. No one fucking knows who they are. And like, even if they told you that what they did, you'd have to like, they'd have to beg to speak at a conference. Whereas yeah. guys like you, you've got like the Daily Show reaching out to you. You've got celebrities reaching out to you who want to like get on board with you. And then it's in the same thing.
Yeah. Cause you can make it sound good. I could say I sold my last startup to Amazon. Yeah. Technically I did. Technically I made money, but
no,
like,
that's not it.
That doesn't make it a huge success, you know. No, it doesn't make me like a thought leader.
I don't think that's the right way to say it because that you're acting like you're tricking people because you've never tricked anyone ever, and I don't think has either. But what you've done is you've both done this really good job of creating a little bit of mystique about. And what I want to know is you can use example and then you. How does someone? I guess I'm asking for myself because how do you create so much of this like brand equity, like you guys have?
Well, I think in both cases, it's basically you put your thoughts on blast. So, you know, they're the real answer. And by the way, I say that not to make fun of any app, I think it did sell for a profit. So good for them. I'm saying I know that I've gotten disproportionate credit for my track record of success when in reality, like the best thing I've built is this D2C company that I don't tell anybody the name of. That's the profitable business that's doing 8 figures a year. But like, that's not actually why people... My reputation came before that. So, you know, that's kind of weird, right? So where does the reputation actually come from? It comes from two things. One is you meet people in real life. So like you go meet, you know, the investors at these different big funds or CEOs of different companies. And when they're talking to you, they're making an independent assessment of your caliber, based on your thoughts. So, right. So first it's like a hand-to-hand combat thing. You meet a bunch of people, you earn their respect one-on-one by, you know, when they're talking about some deal they're doing or a company they're building, you actually contribute by adding value, by pointing out things or giving them criticism or giving them feedback on what's really great, or identifying to them other things that are really cool. And they say, wow, this guy really, you know, I got a lot out of this conversation. So you do that with like 300 people. And those people matter, right? Because they have themselves influence and trust. So for example, Josh Ellman is a good example. This guy was early on at LinkedIn, at Facebook, at Twitter, at Robinhood, like early ish on, meaning he was like head of growth at a bunch of these companies.
Yeah. He's a big deal. He's been on our podcast.
And so he's got, you know, people have a tremendous amount of respect for him because he's had a tremendous career. Well, both and I have, you know, on separate occasions met with Josh, and when we're talking about our startup and whether our startup succeeded or failed, Josh knows, look, you're playing in the sort of like the startup lottery, startup Olympics. A startup can fail and an entrepreneur can still be really great. And if out of that conversation, Josh walks away thinking, oh, this person's really smart. And then they connect you to some other people that they know. And those people say, wow, Josh, thanks for the intro. Sean was really great. You develop a reputation amongst people who have a reputation. So that's the first step. Through real life interactions, you develop a reputation with people who already have a reputation so that they will retweet your stuff, so that they will vouch for you when you have a project or you're doing something. And that goes a long way in the marketplace. So like, for example, I've had Josh or Balaji or different people who have their own big following and their own respect. If they share me or they say this person's great, then a whole bunch of other people just inherit that reputation. They just say, oh, okay, if Josh says he's great, he's great. If Balaji says he's great, he's great.
It's such a unique way of, it's almost like credibility hacking or something like that.
But that's the thing I think is important is like, I'm telling you how the mechanic works, but there's the thing you can't just, the reason it's not a hack is because your thoughts actually have to be interesting. You have to actually.
I don't mean hack like you're a hack. I just mean like getting the desired, the process of getting to the desired outcome.
Right. The second thing is we both created content. So now his tweets are mostly making fun of people who create content and threads and teach courses. But before that, he was doing it himself, right? he himself was saying, you know, when you're building a social app, blah, 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 or here's how we grew inside high schools for TBH. And why did I respect him? Because he released this memo actually got leaked from inside Facebook.
Oh, that, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the memo basically said, he was like, hey, guys at Facebook, here's some of the stuff we did to grow amongst teenagers. And I know Facebook wants to grow amongst teens. Here's some of the stuff we did at TBH. For example, for every high school, we would create an Instagram account branded to the high school. So it'd be like, you know, McKinley High, you know, secrets. And that's the Instagram account. And it would be locked. And we would follow anybody who had McKinley High in their profile. Then they would follow us. You know, 40% of people would follow us back. They would request to follow, but we were private. We wouldn't approve anybody's request. Then at 4 p.m., when everybody got out of school one day, we would accept all the requests. So everybody simultaneously would get a notification about our account. So they would all go check it out. And then they would all see the link to download the app. And then they would download the app. And then as they were downloading the app, they'd get notifications that their friends are all downloading the app today. And it felt like a big deal. And that's how we hacked distribution into high schools. I similarly have told actually a very similar story about how we would go get, our goal was always to get half of a high school to download our app in one day. We did it a completely different way, but I've shared that on podcasts, different places, or on Twitter threads. And people read that and they're like, oh, fuck, this guy's smart. That's a really smart growth tactic. This guy really understands growth. This guy really understands teens. This guy really understands social. And so quote my buddy Jason Hitchcock told me once, he goes, you say one interesting thing, I say, huh, that's interesting. You say two interesting things, I say, huh, those are interesting. You say three interesting things, I say, fuck, this guy's interesting. And that's really what you got to do with content is if you say three original interesting things around one topic, whether it's Bitcoin or media or robotics or whatever, if I get three interesting things from you, I will assign that tag to you. This guy's interesting, worth watching. And then if other people endorse it and say, this is interesting, it goes even faster.
Dude, this is exciting to me. I think this is a fire episode. I don't want to talk about it entirely right now because I think we should wrap here. But so last weekend, when you were sick, so you probably didn't see this, I tweeted out about SDRs, so short-term rental stuff. Did you happen to see that?
I saw it and I followed what you were talking about. Looks super interesting. Your Facebook group. I want to hear more about that. So we can save it for another app if you want.
We'll save it. But did you join the group?
I didn't join the group yet. No, I didn't know the name. Dude, of it. It's called Sam's SDRs or something.
Yeah,
like that.
I just made it in the car. Like Sarah was driving and I just made it in the car.
Smart way to do things, by the way. Like it's going to sound super simple. Like, oh, I just made this thing because you were curious and wanted to learn about it, right? Like you hadn't decided to do anything yet.
But it's, well, I have now, but I'm still looking for a property though. But I,
Sam's STR crew.
Yeah, I'll let you in. And there's like 1,000 or 1,500 people. It's mostly all tech guys. Dude, I've met some guys.
Where'd you get
there.
These people? You tweeted it out?
Just the tweet. That's it. Only that. It's all tech guys. Like it's that guy, AJ, who owns the pet
yep.
business. And then it's Nathan Berry. It's Marshall Haas. There's guys in there that I've met guys that are like billionaires, like who have sold, or rather they've sold companies for $1 billion. I met one guy who's making $500,000 a month in profit. He's paying himself $6 million a year off of his wow. handful of, yeah, there's another guy in there who owns $50 million worth of them. It's crazy. I'm learning all this in this fucking group. It's amazing. So you're going to have to browse through that, and I'll tell you some more interesting stuff about it.
We'll start with that one next time.
Does that interest you?
Dude, of course it interests me. Yeah, that's great.
It's crazy. Who would have thought about short-term rentals and how they're crushing?
It hits the highest level of interesting me, which is where you say, what am I doing with my life? Why don't I do that? All right, you basically question your own life is the highest form of interest.
The thing is that you don't need to, quote, be doing it. You just need to have done it. And there is a world where you not quite set it and forget it, but like you just like, it's not like you need to do shit all the time to it.
Right.
And so I would say like one of the criticisms, not a criticism, but the one of my feedback for Sean and how Sean should like evolve maybe is to sometimes invest in some of these a little bit more boring, stable right. things, at least just a tiny portion of your money. And like, this is like a really interesting asset class.
Have I told you about Steady?
No.
This is sweet. I think you'll like it. So I think the website is cool. Steady. I want to say it's steady.capital or steadycapital.com. One second. Let me pull it
steady,
up.
If I just type in steady.
Okay. Capital. Do steady.capital. STEADY.
How do most.
Tell me what you see.
It's a black screen and it says, how do most millionaires build their wealth? 90% of millionaires invest in real estate. Steady lets you earn passive income from real estate for $100. Okay.
And then
Steady is a web dashboard for retail investors to buy shares of income-generating commercial real estate. Make investments in senior financial reports in our dashboard and get monthly deposits from your investments directly to your bank account. We do not offer high adrenaline.
This is the part I wanted you to read. Yeah.
We do not offer high... This is really good copy. We do not offer high adrenaline investments. We don't have an app designed to keep your eyes glued to your phone. We pursue steady returns over hype. We are the tortoise in a race full of hares.
So
wonderful,
good.
Wonderful.
So good.
Who owns this?
So I read this. So this guy I used to play pickup basketball with, or he was on my like intramural basketball team. This guy Dylan, he created this company. I just kind of saw his Twitter and I was like, oh, what's that guy Dylan up to? Like, I didn't even know he's a startup guy. Like he's just some dude we used to play ball with. And I was like, Steady Capital, what's that? And I read this landing page and I was like, dude, what is this? I got to invest. Literally, so I invested in both his company as well as I started putting my money into Steady. This is why
you invested in Steady?
Yeah, because I was like, dude, this is what I want. I was like, I want to have real estate income coming in, but I don't want to do the work of like going and finding a property, diligencing it, underwriting it, taking out a loan for myself, buying the property, managing the property, all that good stuff. So what these guys do is they basically handpick sponsors. So they'll have like guys who have a good track record in commercial real estate. Commercial real estate, they'll be like, oh, this guy buys warehouses in the middle of Texas. And they basically diligence the properties for you. And then all you do, so what I do, I just said auto invest. So I just say $5,000 a month, just as a starting point. I was like, I'm going to invest $5,000 a month into commercial real estate. Cool. Over this year, I'll have $60,000 put into this. And then it just shows me, it's like, cool, you're going to break even in 18 months, but you're going to get your first check next month. And, basically what they do is they go to that sponsor. They say, hey, you know, you're going to raise money for this deal anyways. Give us $500,000. We have this cadre of investors. We come in as one line item on your thing and we become an investor. And then you just like, our investors want passive income through real estate investing. And he's like, he's trying to do like the Robinhood model where it's like Robinhood made it where there was no fee. You could invest for a very small amount of money. So it's like, normally, real estate has pretty high barriers to entry for knowledge as well as the amount of money you have to put in. So his mission is like, I want to make real estate as, you know, investable for even $100. And even $100, if you're earning 8%, great, you'll earn $8 of passive income.
And is this thing going to be big, you think? It looks cool.
I think it's a really hard business to do because, you know, you have to, it's like a two-sided market. You have to have really, you know, quality deals. But honestly, like these aren't like for example, with startup investing, I don't just give my money to anybody for startup investing because I'm like, dude, are your deals any good or are they all dog shit? With real estate, it's like these are like the property. Like there's so much data about the property. It's collateralized by the property. The guy's got a track record. You're not looking for the next
Uber, the 1000x return. You're looking for something that's going to generate 8 to 10% a year, 8 to 15% a year. And cool, like that's doable. That's not, that doesn't take a miracle. So I really like Steady. I think there's currently a wait list or whatever. People have to like,
dude, I just signed up for it. It looks sick.
Oh yeah, I'll email the guy to get you in. If people want to do it, they should get it. I think this is really good for people. Like I've had multiple people ask to invest in my startup fund, and I just say no. I'm like, if you're not already wealthy, don't do this, because this, don't use this as the way to get wealthy. You have much smarter paths to get there. If you already if you're already multimillionaire, cool. You should do this then to get some exposure to startups. But I think for most people, getting exposure to passive income real estate is a much better place to build wealth if you're not already wealthy through your business or whatever.
Dude, this is a good episode. I'm interested in Steady.
I have a whole bunch of other topics still, so I'll save those for Wednesday. I appreciate you holding down the fort while I was...
It was hard. I think like I had to do it with Ben, and Ben's great. But then I did it with Noah, and Noah's great. But you and I you're talented, which I talk about all the time. You and I together are talented, and it was very hard with, it was way harder with, it was work.
I love to hear it. I love to be needed.
It was work, dude. It was work. And like, I thought there's been times where I'm like, oh fuck, I could handle this. It was work. I felt like I was working.
By the way, if people haven't listened to the episode you did with Ben on the Silk Road, it's on our feed. It's a special, I think it's called Special Episode Silk Road. I don't know what it's called. Go listen to that. I listened to that while I was sick. I fucking loved it. Because I've been meaning to read American Kingpin for so long. You told me it was so good. And I'm just like, backed up. I'm just not reading it. And so listening to that gave me my fix. And it's like, you know, the best kind of Netflix shows where after it's done, you then go down the rabbit hole and research more for like an hour on your phone in the middle of the night under the covers. Like, that's what I was doing about the Silk Road after.
Dude, that one, I think we were prepared for 45 minutes. It wasn't a lot. But we were both so fascinated by that topic. And I think something happened where you weren't able to come. And right. We found last minute and we're like, let's just do this, Ben. And so we're going to do another one on a guy called, I forget, there's another version. There's another like juicy one. But I just bought the book. I'm going to go read it and like do it. Those episodes were fun. And Ben's really good at that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And you guys play off each other really well. The one thing I really wanted to know, because while you're here, I'll get you. How did they catch him? So you had said like basically they traced his. You had said okay, he had originally posted on this forum saying, hey, has anybody seen this thing? And then also that they caught him in the library right down the street from you. So I got those bits, but I wanted to know
how, like, they know it was him.
Yeah, and like I think there was a bunch of details about like the investigation, like that the cop chase basically.
So basically,
was there more there?
It's so funny. There's this episode of South Park where they're trying to like track this terrorist, and the boys are like, dude, just like do a reverse Google search and like just use Google. And that's what they did. And so the very first post ever about the Silk Road was written from a username, and that same username posted a few weeks prior to Stack Overflow saying, I'm building a website that is trying to do this. Can you please email me RossAlbright@gmail.com? Gotcha. And then they like used Web Archive, because once Ross caught his air, he changed his username from like Altoid to like Frosty or something like that. But it was on the web where like he was asking, he used a username to post about, I'm creating a website, or no, sorry, he created a username. It says, has anyone heard about this new thing called Silk Road? And that was the first time anyone ever mentioned it. But just weeks prior, that same username asked about like how to build an exchange or something like that. Gotcha. And then they found out who this Ross guy was. And then they realized that, we just like went to this guy's house recently as Homeland Security, because he ordered like 18 IDs with his picture, but for like different states with different names. Let's keep an eye on him. And they found out, basically, was like, all right, whenever... And so they had a fake... they had an FBI guy become an employee of the Silk Road.
Right.
And Ross, or Dread Pirate Roberts, the owner, would say, like, all right, I got to log off to go blank. They noticed that Ross would walk out of his house and go for a walk.
Right.
Like, they just tracked him. Or they're like, all right, I got to go to Dominican Republic to do blank. And they're like, oh, Ross is in Dominican Republic on vacation, according to his Facebook.
Right.
And so they knew the FBI, the day he was arrested, he got arrested in the library right down the street from my house in Glen Park. And they said, basically, the FBI was, do not arrest him. We got to get a SWAT team. And they're like, dog, he's on his computer right now. We're chatting with him.
And they tackled him, right?
He's logged in this second. We know we're having a conversation with him. And so they had two FBI agents. He was sitting at a chair in the science of this library that I used to go to. He was sitting at a desk in a chair, and they had two FBI agents dressed as kind of homeless people go right behind him and get into a fight where the guy was like, "Bitch, what are you doing here?" And the lady was like, "Fuck you, man. You don't know." Like, you know, like they got in like a domestic disturbance. And so he turns his back. And when he turns his back, the other FBI agents, one tackles him and the other one swipes his computer from his desk and runs it straight to the van. And they plug it. They already had they knew that he was using a PC. They had the outlet right there. They turn the video camera on and they start filming them. They go, "Look, here's the fucking, he's on the dashboard right now as we speak. Here's us. We're literally just talking to him." And then they plug a USB in and they get a lot of the stuff out before the computer goes to sleep and is locked. And so that's
how is there no movie? Like, I know there's like a kind of a shitty documentary about it. Why isn't there an amazing movie about this?
There needs to be. It's such a good story. The book American Kingpin is the best book I've read in years and years. It is such a fascinating story. And it's also, as we said in the podcast, it's an incredibly challenging story for someone like me, because this guy Ross looks like me, right? Like, when you hear about gangsters and shit, they're usually like poor, oftentimes minorities, and like, well, that's like the other. That person's not, you know, I don't relate to that person. Ross was from a good family, a white guy, a good looking dude who lived in San Francisco, played on computers, had these ideals of like, I want to help the world. And you're like, oh, he's just like me. Right. But he's a fucking criminal who tried to like supposedly wanted to kill people and sold more drugs than Al Capone. And so it makes you question, like, what's right and what's wrong.
Yeah, dude, it's so good. Go listen to the episode if you like that little bit. But it was really good. So that definitely got me through one of the COVID fever nights. I got my fever going. I'm listening to the Silk Road. I got all kinds of crazy ideas in my head. It was awesome.
All right, that's the episode. Oh, we have to do one thing before we go. So we 2 or 3 weeks, 4 weeks ago at this point, we did a contest on TikTok where we were going to give $5,000 to at least one person who created videos about using our YouTube videos and chopped them up and posted them on whatever platform and used our clips. So the end result on TikTok alone, our hashtags in like the first 2 weeks got something like 30 million views. Do you know that?
Damn.
And we're giving, Jonathan, confirm in the chat, are we giving it to the people that I think it's the cartoon? Let me know. But the first guy that we're, yeah, okay. And it's the first guy we're giving it to, his name on TikTok, I believe, was MFM Minis. I think his name is Michael. And he posted a bunch of videos. A few of them got more than a million views.
No,
his
MFM Cuts, right?
I can't get that wrong. Because there was an MFM Minis as well. Jonathan, tell me exactly who the winner is in the chat. I can't get that wrong. MFM Cuts is the winner. And this person got something like, so MFM Cuts, that's the winner. MFM Cuts, that's the winner. This person got like 30,000 followers on their TikTok channel in like 10 or 15 days, millions of views. They won. And then the second place person who also gets $5,000, I think they're called Tune Pods. Is that what they're called? Say it again.
Pod Tune. Mr. Pod Tune. So they turn podcasts into cartoons like South Park style. We've retweeted a couple of them because they're awesome.
And they are hilarious. They are really good. So the best one was where I was making fun of you for not wearing a shirt. Hilarious. Really good. I have a feeling both of these guys are going to end up making a lot of money by turning this into a business. And I bet they already have.
Yeah, exactly. Good job. Good job by them.
By the way, MFM Cuts, the guy, he is in university still. When I emailed him, he's 19.
I love it. Good job by them. Is this still going? Can people still win next month? A different person could win or no?
Yeah, we're going to keep doing it. We got to wait. I got to wait till Jonathan tells me we're allowed to announce it, but we are going to continue doing it because we saw in December, our podcast, basically in November, we were like just shy of a million. In December, we basically skipped over a million and went straight to 2 million. Yeah. And I think that TikTok thing was one of the reasons why it happened. One of a couple of reasons.
Yeah. And did we do this other winner too, the 60-minute thing?
We'll announce that next time.
Okay, sounds good. All right, I got to go. Good stuff. Good seeing you again.
All right, I'll talk to you soon. Good episode.
Hey
everyone, a quick break. My favorite podcast guest on My First Million is Dharmesh. Dharmesh founded HubSpot. He's a billionaire. He's one of my favorite entrepreneurs on earth. And on one of our podcasts recently, he said the most valuable skill that anyone could have when it comes to making money in business is copywriting. And when I say copywriting, what I mean is writing words that get people to take action. And I agree, by the way. I learned how to be a copywriter in my 20s. It completely changed my life. I ended up starting and selling a company for tens of millions of dollars. And copywriting was the skill that made all of that happen. And the way that I learned how to copywrite is by using a technique called copywork, which is basically taking the best sales letters and I would write it word for word. And I would make notes as to why each phrase was impactful and effective. And a lot of people have been asking me about copywork. So I decided to make a whole program for it. It's called Copy That. Copy That. .com. It's only like $120 and it's a simple, fast, easy way to improve your copywriting. And so if you're interested, you need to check it out. It's called Copy That. You can check it out at copythat.com.